You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast produced by Veteran Strategies and featuring conversations with fascinating and impactful men and women who have shaped our world, our communities, and our history. My name is Robert Vane, principal of Veteran Strategies, and your host for our discussion. You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, an Indiana-based public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Garmon Construction, Leaders and Legends LLC, the Grand Hall and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, the McGinley's Golden Ace Inn, and NFP, a national insurance broker with strong local content. Our podcast is featured on the All Indiana Podcast Network in partnership with Wish TV. You may find Leaders and Legends at allindianapodcastnetwork.com. Thinking of starting a podcast or need to host a public meeting? Let Leaders and Legends LLC be your partner as you look for new ways to communicate your message. Please contact Chris Spangle or me at leadersandlegends.net. And as always, all our podcast interviews are dedicated to the legacy and generosity of P.E. McAllister. Thank you for joining us on the Leaders and Legends podcast. Our guest today is Joshua Claiborne. He is an attorney. He's an historian. He's an author. He is probably, one of the most informed and scholarly voices when it comes to the early life, the Indiana life of Abraham Lincoln. He is very prominent on social media, has written books, he's edited books, and the delay in me getting him on this podcast is inexcusable. Joshua, thank you for coming on Leaders and Legends.
I appreciate it. I was looking, it looks like we're not yet to 100 episodes, so I guess I at least snuck in on one of the first 100. Is that accurate?
No, you're looking at the wrong side.
Oh, dang it. Okay.
You may actually be my 250th by the time I post it.
Oh, okay. Never mind. Wow, I'm way behind then.
Because I'm going to post our interview on Monday. I post all of our interviews on Monday. Okay. And in 2024, Monday is February 12th.
Okay.
The birthday of Abraham Lincoln.
Absolutely. As it is. Yes. Yeah.
Everyone who reads any history at some point falls in love with Abraham Lincoln. It's the universal language. I could get six Republicans and six Democrats, and if you start talking about Lincoln, they'd all be thrilled. When did the Lincoln bug bite you?
Lincoln grew up in southwestern Indiana, ultimately became a lawyer, was heavily involved in politics. That pretty succinctly sums up myself too. And so we traveled a lot of the same life paths, geographically, career-wise, interest-wise. It was just a natural person, a natural historical figure for me to gravitate towards.
I'm going to ask this question because I get into a little bit, not fussing at people. You have studied his time period in Indiana most intently. I had a boss at the State House who told me that Lincoln's entire life was shaped because of his time in Indiana. That seems to me to be a bit of a hyperbole. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 meaning it had no impact, and 10 meaning it completely shaped him. How did Abraham Lincoln's time as a Hoosier affect and influence his life?
Oh, man, the number is going to be hard, but it was certainly substantial. I'll put it this way. Lincoln spent from age 7 to 21 in southwestern Indiana. And I like to tell audiences when I talk with them about Lincoln, imagine your own life from age 7 to 21. How important and impactful were those years on you, what you believe, who you are, your worldview? For most people, certainly for me, that period was overwhelmingly substantial. Probably my worldview was shaped as much in that period of time as any other in my life. That's not to say we don't continue to evolve and change, but so much of who we are is shaped at that time. And so I believe the same was true for Lincoln. And I think what we know about him from a historic standpoint, bears that out. So Indiana was critical to who he is. And I think, unfortunately, it's far too often overlooked, including by Lincoln historians.
Why? Lincoln was famously born in Kentucky, Hodgenville, I think, yes. Kentucky, February 12th, 1809. Why did his family move from Kentucky to Indiana?
Lincoln says there were two reasons. One of them was on account of land titles. When you would buy land in Kentucky, it would be from the tree on the hill to the rock by the stream type thing, right? And the tree can get cut down and the rock can move. And so there is often a lot of disputes over land. And when you thought you were making a better life for yourself in Kentucky, it often turned out that you were really just welcoming in a lawsuit from somebody else who wanted your land. But Lincoln says the other principal reason, seemingly equally strong, was slavery. Lincoln's father was opposed to slavery. The family was opposed to it. Slavery was in Kentucky, and they wanted to get to a northern state where it did not exist. So it was a combination of economic opportunity, organization of land grants, and slavery that all drove the Lincoln family to move from Kentucky northward.
How soon after Lincoln moved and the family moved from Kentucky to Indiana did his mother die? Did she die in Kentucky?
No, she died in Indiana in 1818. So Lincoln would have been 9 years old. His sister was just a couple years older than Lincoln. At the time, too, Indiana was quite primitive. It was a pioneer area where you literally had to carve your way out of the forest to build a home in many ways. Plenty of danger just from not having enough people around, but also wolves and bears, et cetera, sickness without medical attention. And really for a family to survive, you needed two parents in many ways. It wasn't just, oh, I'm lonely and want somebody to love. In many ways, it was a survival issue. Losing a parent was both an emotional devastation, but also simply a practical devastation. So to lose your mother at nine is a big deal. And then the father, Thomas, actually effectively soon after left the family, go back to Kentucky to find a new wife.
He just left Lincoln and his sister, just left them.
Correct. Now they did have effectively who acted like a cousin, a guy named Dennis Hanks, who was there. He was a little older, but not much older. And that also caused Lincoln to grow a lot closer to his sister because they relied on each other. Even if both parents live, you're surviving in the wilderness on the frontier alone. You're naturally going to bond and grow close. But then to lose the mother, lose his mother as he did, his sister in many ways came a surrogate mother of sorts as well when all that happened.
And Thomas Lincoln came back with a wife.
That's correct. And she, in many ways, and her official name was, full name was Sarah Bush Johnston. She, in many ways, wasn't just a stepmother to Lincoln, but really treated him, by all accounts, as her own son. And really, importantly, helped foster his love of learning. He loved to read. His father famously wanted him out using his hands on the farm. That was how Thomas Lincoln had survived himself. And he wanted to pass on to his kids the importance of earning a living through your hands, farming and carpentry. But Lincoln was just obsessed with ideas, and he wanted to read and learn and be part of ideas. And his stepmother, Sarah, really fostered and fed that, which was critical to his development.
And Abraham Lincoln also needed the counterbalance because his relationship, and please go on about this because it's crucially important during this time in his life, Lincoln's relationship with his father, I mean, awful, disastrous, what word do you, certainly contentious, what word do you want to use? Harsh?
Well, I will tell you, this is a matter of increasing debate among Lincoln historians. The traditional view is that Lincoln and his father had a very strained relationship, that the father was stern, unemotional, detached, and did not care about Lincoln's interests in learning and ideas. And famously, people like to focus in on an incident when Lincoln's father, Thomas, was dying. Lincoln was in Washington. Lincoln received a letter from the family saying, he's dying, you come home. And Lincoln said, I don't think I should. It would just be too painful. And people take all of those clues and put together this picture of Thomas that we have. And then on top of that, relative to East Coast writers, the Lincolns lived quite poorly, right? Their first home in Indiana was a three-sided lean-to. So they say not only was he emotionally detached, but he must not have really provided very well for the family either. And that has been the perception we've had of Thomas. Some of that was borne out from a desire to make Lincoln be out to be someone that rose from great depths and was a self-made man. So not only did he have to come out of poverty, but he had to do it without a father that cared about him. And so that fit well within that narrative. But there's been a lot of pushback to that, and a lot of folks that have said, really, Thomas was a typical father for someone at that time in that place. You had to be somebody who focused on farming and who focused on surviving. That most fathers in that time were hard on their children and drove them to work. Most fathers in that time in that place did not care about reading. It was a waste of time. So there's been a lot of pushback that, in fact, he was a normal father, and also other people pushing back that Lincoln's letter may be mischaracterized and that the painfulness could just be, why go see someone pass away when I have better memories? And also, he's dealing with quite a bit in DC at the time. Again, that debate will continue, but certainly a lot of people from Indiana in particular are trying to rescue at least somewhat Thomas's perception.
You're listening to the Leaders and Legends podcast. We're talking with Lincoln scholar Joshua Claiborne. He's zooming in from Evansville, Indiana. Another aspect of the Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Lincoln dynamic is the fact that, and I don't think anyone's pushing back on this, but maybe the original thesis no longer holds. Lincoln let his kids do anything and everything. They did. They ran amok everywhere. They interrupted meetings. They shot at each other. They shot at office seekers. And the Tad and Willie's exploits in the White House are legendary. Is that a fair pairing to make, where that Lincoln had a harsh father, therefore he wasn't going to be harsh to his kids?
I think that's a fair characterization. He was not the father Thomas was. And he was far more into joking and cutting up and freewheeling, was not stern or taskmaster. So yeah, I think you characterized it well. There's even some famous jokes about one of the kids talking about peeing on a desk, and Lincoln thought that was funny, right? And it's hard to imagine Thomas being okay with those kind of antics.
Kids were, the boys, the young boys, not Robert, he was gone, but the young boys were biters. They would bite people on the leg during meetings. Love it. What else occupied Lincoln's time when he was in Indiana?
He certainly learned the value of hard work. I think his view of capitalism, the free market, certainly shaped it. He told a story at length of one time he ferried some passengers from the side of the river to a boat in the middle of it. They tossed some coins in, a half silver dollar, and it just two half silver dollars, and it changed his perception and outlook on life. He realized that this poor guy on the frontier had a way of earning a living and bettering himself. That certainly shaped his view of the economy, and I think some would argue that shaped his view of slavery as well, because a lot of his views on slavery wasn't just the ethical, this is wrong as a humanity thing, but also this is wrong economically. People working hard should have a chance to reap the rewards of that hard work.
And that came out in one of his debates with Senator Stephen Douglas, one of the famous debates.
Yes.
I don't know that I'll get the quote exactly right, Joshua, so please correct me, but he basically said I think he was talking about the black woman, when it comes to the fruit of her labors, she's the equal of me, Senator Douglas, right, and everyone else. That's pretty close, if not.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I think you got the essence of it for sure. I think that view is largely shaped on the frontier, where people moved there for economic opportunity. So not only did he witness it himself, but he was surrounded by people that, including some store clerks and store owners in particular, that were Whigs at the time, that really pushed and championed that idea. Slavery itself was likely arguably something that influenced him while in Indiana, because while in Indiana, he took a flatboat trip as a teenager down to New Orleans to sell some goods. It's pretty remarkable to think about what all they did. Even with a cell phone, I wouldn't let my teenage child get on a flatboat and go all the way to New Orleans today, yet alone without modern technology. And at layer on top of that, at the time, there were actual river pirates. And in fact, they were attacked by runaway slaves. It was dangerous for all sorts of reasons to go on that trip. But once they got to New Orleans, Lincoln would have absolutely seen slave markets. And there's some apocryphal quotes attributed to him. That trip and seeing the slave markets then is what set his mind towards always working to end slavery. Now, I and a lot of other historians think, again, that's apocryphal. I don't believe he actually said that, but I don't doubt he saw slavery occur. And I think it would have had a very big impact on him.
Is there any indication that, and I don't think it was in a debate, so correct me if you know when he said it or wrote it. Lincoln wrote that, talked about labor being the superior of capital. Is that a familiar phrase to you? And yeah. Also, do you think that his time in Indiana helped shape that view?
Yes, I think so. I think the quotation is something along the lines of labor is the superior of capital and deserves
much higher consideration.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that goes back to a lot of the pioneer people pushing west for opportunity, and they did that with labor, as opposed to folks in New York who are getting rich off money and investments. That's what he knew. It's what he understood. It's what he was around, and he valued that. And I absolutely think that influenced his approach to slavery and so many others at the time.
It would be, would it not, an exaggeration to call Lincoln an abolitionist at any point of his political career up to the Emancipation Proclamation? In other words, he wasn't this anti-slavery zealot, William Lloyd Garrison, a John Brown,
right?
A Charles Sumner, Thaddeus Stevens, the list goes on. He clearly had significant moral and economic qualms with it, but it wasn't like he was some sort of itinerant abolitionist preacher.
That's right. Now, I think Lincoln's views evolved over time throughout his life towards more and more of the abolitionist perspective. But I absolutely agree, Robert. I mean, he was a pragmatist, and he famously said himself that his first priority was the Union far more than slavery. And if he had to pick between the two, he would keep the Union over abolishing slavery. That was his focus. That's what he cared about most. But there is no doubt either that he did abhor slavery and thought it was wrong. But he wasn't going to risk the division of the United States over it, in part because he felt like it was going to die a natural death, right? So why escalate something too fast that has the risk of disintegrating the country when it's going to end eventually anyway?
And the genesis of his belief that it will die on the vine, or the foundation of it, really was rooted in the fact that it should not be allowed to spread.
Correct.
That if it's just confined to these states, that eventually it'll go away. But if it flourishes in other states, then it has a much greater chance to live.
That's absolutely correct. Yep.
How did he work? He was a congressman for a couple of years. Was it 46 to 48 or 47 to 49 or something like that? How did he work against the extension of slavery before he became president of the United States?
There were different pieces of legislation, certainly, that he was around or part of or arguing on behalf of. He continued to campaign for candidates who had that same view of containing slavery. And he would continue to engage in debates and written, but whether verbal or written, and or oral or written, I should say. And he was always at the forefront of pushing that. But as you say, there is no doubt that preserving the Union was still the priority.
How did Lincoln look back upon his years in Indiana? We know what scholars and authors say now, but my good friend, I was lucky enough to be friendly with him Senator Andy Jacobs, or excuse me, Congressman Andy Jacobs, who was part of the Lincoln Bicentennial Commission. He and I would talk about that. Is Indiana something he looked back on fondly?
He didn't talk a whole lot about Indiana, and that's partially why we don't hear a lot about it. He did come back to Indiana after he moved to Illinois to campaign for Henry Clay and stump for him in his home region, including what is now Spencer County. And he actually wrote a poem that he was inspired to write. And one of them, it said, "My childhood home, I see again and gladden with the view. And still, as memories crowd my brain, there's sadness in it too." So it's a mixture, right? There's certainly happiness for so much of his growth and probably a lot of fond memories, but sadness because he had to endure a lot of hardship financially, but his mother died, his sister died. Again, it wasn't a life of luxury in Indiana. So there were certainly, I have to think, based on that poem and other clues we have, that there were mixed emotions, but there's no doubt he identified with Indiana. That poem ends with this stanza: "The very spot where grew the beard that formed my bones, I see. How strange, old field, on thee to tread and feel I'm part of thee." You can't say it much clearer than that. He felt a part of the fields of Indiana when he returned. It was part of who he was. And I go back to what I said at the beginning of our podcast here, that, you know, most people that move around a lot in their life, if they spend somewhere from age 7 to 21, they're going to identify a lot with that area. I personally, if I lived in, you know, took the same route that Lincoln did, I would probably identify as a Hoosier most, because that's where my formative years were. There's always a big debate between Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois as to who gets to claim them, but I think we have as much of a claim as any other state.
Did he have law cases here after he started down that road?
No, he really didn't take up the practice of law till he moved to Illinois, but he was fascinated with it. He went to watch oral arguments of trials that were going on. And for the lawyers and judges in the area, he would go and pester them to borrow their books all the time. And he would get them, read them over and over. So people in Illinois like to say that's where he learned the law. That is where he practiced under a lawyer, but there is no doubt he was reading law books and was talking with lawyers and judges while in Indiana. So I actually think we get a pretty good argument that he was from here. And there was actually a pretty big, this allegedly, as the story goes, there was a big murder case in Boonville that Lincoln went to watch. The lawyer allegedly went to D.C. to meet with Lincoln, and Lincoln allegedly said to him, "That case you argued for, the murder case, is what inspired me to become a lawyer." Some later historians questioned that for, I think, unfounded reasons. They said there were no murder cases that occurred at the area during the time. I actually proved there were murder cases. I spent several weeks in courthouses digging through materials and found there were murder cases, and that particular lawyer, Brackenridge, was a lawyer on a murder case. So we don't know for sure if that happened, but there is no doubt that Lincoln watched cases here. He would have had plenty of opportunity. It was, you know, back at that period of time when the circuits would come through town, it was like a circus, right?
Right.
People would come and watch the law cases. And so, of course, if everybody else is going, somebody who's interested in ideas and the law and drama like Lincoln is absolutely going to find time and make sure he gets to go watch it too. So, he may not have formally studied under lawyers in Indiana, but I think he was truly inspired to become a lawyer while in Indiana.
You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, an Indiana-based public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Garmon Construction, Leaders and Legends LLC, the Grand Hall and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, the McGinley's Golden Ace Inn, and NFP, a national insurance broker with strong local content. Our guest today is Lincoln historian, scholar, and attorney. You got it all wrapped up there, Joshua. Joshua Claiborne. Joshua, is there, excepting Mr. Lincoln, of course, is there a Hoosier leader and or legend you particularly admire?
Besides Chris Spangle? Is that what you're saying?
I'm talking about, no one can compare. So throw out Benjamin Harrison and all those guys. Yes.
Yeah. Lincoln has to take the cake for me. I guess if you want to start more recently, I have a lot to admire in Mitch Daniels. I think he's done such a tremendous job in modern times of helping steer the ship in the right direction here in Indiana. I think he'll be somebody we talk about for a few generations to come. We often fall toward politicians, but I think there's others in the business community, in the business realm, the arts realms as well that can be just as impactful. So I think of people like even somebody like Bobby Knight, as controversial as he was, what his impact in terms of teaching and diligence and that sort of thing are just as important as politicians or others. I'd be curious to hear, Robert, your answer on that question.
Which leader? My answer is going to be P.E. McAllister, and that's a somewhat parochial answer because he is both beloved and, according to my daughter, the cutest. And he passed away a few years, and his impact on Indianapolis is truly immeasurable. And if you needed proof, I could get Jim Morris and Al Hubbard and Mark Miles and Richard Lugar and Mitch Daniels, and they to talk about them all in a room, and it would never end. That's modern. As far as historically, I'm a fan of Lew Wallace.
Yeah, he was on my mind too. Yeah.
You know, the author of Ben-Hur. We've had six vice presidents. We have Ann Baxter. We have Shelley Long. We have Florence Henderson. So, yeah. You know, Indiana's had this impact, but those would be the two, obviously Cole Porter, Hoagy Carmichael, the list goes on. But in modern times, but I would say this, the most impressive leader I have met in my life, who's not an elected official, so not Mitch Daniels, not Greg Ballard, is Mark Miles, who's come on the podcast twice, who runs the Indianapolis Motor Speedway or was in charge of the Super Bowl. It's just an amazing resume and the kind of leadership that makes a difference from one generation to the other. In other words, because of what he did years ago, we're able to do what we do now here in Indianapolis. Lloyd Winicky was a hell of a mayor down in Evansville. Obviously, I should do a shout out to Suzanne Crouch, Lieutenant Governor, who's from Evansville. One of the things that's used to describe Southern Indiana, and I've seen this in more than one book, I have read Southern Indiana to be described as more like the South than any other part of the North. Is that a statement that you find
accurate? I hear that a lot, and then I bristle at it, and then yet I find it hard to argue.
I guess it's meant to be an insult. I don't take it that way, but
I think you're right. As Northerners, we're maybe instinctively, it's wait a minute, that's not right. But there is so much truth to it. Even historically, Indiana itself was settled from the South up, right? That's how it happened. And so many people that live here in Southern Indiana, their ancestors came from Kentucky by way of North Carolina and Tennessee and Virginia. There is a lot of Southern ancestry, first of all, but also just economically, in so many ways, we down in Southern Indiana are tied to Kentucky, or you know, that sort of thing. And so now I-69 has helped bridge that gap some, but nonetheless, that inevitably leads to that. I guess you could say the same thing about the region is more like Chicago than anything else. And so in many ways we are, but for whatever reason, I feel like Southern Indiana has more of that Southern flair than you might find even in Southern Illinois or Southern Ohio.
Is it also fair to say that before the controversy of slavery that took place in the early to mid 19th century, that Indiana would have been described as the West, not the North?
Oh, absolutely it was. Yeah, absolutely. That's where we get the term Northwest Territory. Because that's how people thought of it. You were moving west. This was the West. St. Louis was the end of the road for so long. And of course,
it's slavery that defined North and South.
Right. Yep.
Does Indiana get a bad rap for being seen as, because obviously we can talk about Oliver P. Morton and our contribution to the Civil War, the victory of the North, but Morgan Drayders and some of the other things way down by the river, it was seen to be, if not rebel territory, certainly rebel sympathizing.
when I was, I will admit, when you asked about my favorite or maybe most influential Hoosiers, Oliver P. Morton came to mind. I know our libertarian friends would bristle at that suggestion. As a lawyer who loves the rule of law, there's no doubt that Governor Morton skirted it in pursuit of helping the Civil War be victorious. But it is an interesting counterfactual to wonder what would have happened had Oliver Morton not done what he did.
How about not become governor, because he was supposed to be senator, and then they go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, so he's certainly controversial for how he went about it. What would the alternative have been? But there's no doubt in the South, you had a lot more slave sympathies. You had a lot more Democrat areas. Lincoln famously lost his home county. And even after the Civil War, for decades later, it was a hotbed, although Indianapolis was as well, of Ku Klux Klan activity, too. And that's not to say that everybody from the South or associated with Southern culture is racist in the same way the KKK is, but I think that's an indicator of something that is more closely tied to a Southern phenomenon, but flourished in Southern Indiana at the time.
Would you say that there was a particular epiphany when it comes to Luger's, mercy, forgive me, when it comes to President Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's views on slavery? And at a certain point, whether he looked upon it as malignant, but then he started to want to do something about it. And that's a big watershed.
Yeah. But some of it could have just been practical. Like he always wanted to, but he didn't want to at the expense of the Union. My sense is at some point there was a realization that there is no halfway measure, right? That the Union is split apart. They want to lead even with these sort of half steps. And moreover, by freeing the slaves, we have the potential of breaking the South and breaking the war. So I think it's a combination of practical concerns that ending slavery had practical advantages, but also moral and ethical ones that he'd always had where he did not agree with slavery. I think it was a combination of the two.
Did he ever, there's a debate on how much slavery contributed to the Civil War. My answer would be 99.999. And other people have different views. What was Lincoln's view?
Yeah, there was no question, zero question, that slavery was the absolute root cause, both historically, but also in Lincoln's and in his own mind and what he felt like was the cause of it. There's just no doubt about it.
How did Indiana fare contribute to the victory of the North in the Civil War?
Indiana was critical in terms of Union troops on a per capita basis. Indiana, I don't have the exact statistics in front of me, but Indiana really came out in terms of volunteers and providing soldiers. Also, again, thanks to Governor Morton, resources in terms of money and cash were critical. Other types of resources beyond just soldiers. State of the North was important. And again, you could say without Ohio, we wouldn't have won, or without Illinois, we wouldn't have won. But I think you could maybe make that argument for Indiana, or at least it would have been a dramatically different war without Indiana. So there's no doubt that we were one of the very critical components to success and victory.
Lincoln famously said, "I would like to have God on my side, but I must have Kentucky." Is he right on that?
I think he, being so close to Kentucky, he intrinsically understood the region and how hard it would be to hold the Northwest Territory with Kentucky lost. And conversely, how much easier it would be to break the South with control of Kentucky. That was obviously a focal point and was a watershed moment when Grant and others in the West were able to break through and secure so much of the critical waterways and railways of Kentucky. A lot of the West sort of fell off with it. Now, Tennessee was obviously equally important, but Kentucky was the big first hurdle that really set in motion so much of the rest of the success.
Because the rivers in the East were impediments to invasion, and the rivers in the West were avenues of invasion.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah.
Let's talk about Lincoln as commander in chief. And by that, is it an overstatement to say Lincoln created the position of commander in chief. It's in the Constitution, but the way that he did it, formed it, asserted himself, created what we would call the modern notion of the president of the United States is the commander in chief.
I think that's fair. I think some of that is due to his tremendous curiosity in terms of learning about military tactics. He didn't just give a blank check to his generals. He wanted to understand why they were doing something. And he gave them plenty of rope to operate as they saw fit, but he wanted to be kept informed and aware of it. And he had a good sense that when they had enough rope to hang themselves, it was time to switch horses and get a new commander. But I think that's a fair assessment.
But the duties of the position, for lack of a term, responsibilities, commander in chief, are mentioned in the Constitution, but they're not defined.
Yeah.
And Lincoln defined them.
He did help define it. There's no question about that. Yeah.
Do you rate Lincoln's performance as commander in chief high?
I do. It was not an easy task. I think being commander in chief involves balancing taking into account the political considerations. And that was where he was a master. He could balance all of the competing interests that were pulling him in 100 different directions and herd the various cats in the right direction. I think he did a great job with that.
As a counterpoint, is it also fair to say that his political sense, or his sense that, hey, these folks here are supporters and we had to take care of them, led to generals like Benjamin Butler and Nathaniel Banks and others that were just plain, there's no other word, they were terrible.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that he would appoint people again, because politically, had he not, there would not be the support for getting those troops or those resources. So he appointed people to higher positions. I love this anecdote that came out in one of the histories on Grant, that with the election over in 1864, Grant submitted a list of 8 major generals and 33 brigadiers who he wanted out of the service. He wanted to kick them out. And some were kicked out. He wanted out because they were political generals: Franz Sigel, John McClernand, Carl Schurz. Grant had long questioned it, but like Lincoln, understood that they had to stay for the war. But the election was over. He submitted the list, and Lincoln said, "Grant, I thought these officers were friends of yours. Are you sure you want them all dropped?" And Grant's response, I thought, was patriotic and telling. He said, "That's very true, Mr. President, but my personal friends are not always good generals," and terminated him. But I thought it was an admission that these people were there for political reasons. And when they had the opportunity to get rid of them because they didn't need the politics anymore, they did that.
Listening to the Leaders and Legends podcast, we're talking with attorney, historian, author, and Lincoln scholar, Joshua Claiborne. It's been a long time, but I gave a speech to Civil War roundtables throughout the Midwest on the relationship between Lincoln and Grant, because to me, it's the most important relationship of the war. What brought Lincoln and Grant so close? Because there really isn't any commander-in-chief and commanding general relationship like this prior to the Civil War. As a matter of fact, in some cases, it's very contentious between Polk and Taylor, that sort of thing. But they developed a bond that is, I think, still unique in American history.
Yeah, and I think, Robert, I consider myself an expert on Lincoln's Indiana years, so I'm going to get a little bit out of my comfort zone with an expert like you and the relationship between Grant and Lincoln. But I'll tell you from my perspective, what has always struck me is they had similar background. At least they had similar mentalities, which, for lack of a better word, is a bit of a working class mentality. They had both been from the Midwest. They were both willing to get their hands dirty. They were both blunt, focused on results, not on the flair and the pomp and circumstance that so many others were focused on at that level. They wanted to get stuff done. They wanted to get it done well. And like I said, I think they had a certain humility about them without too much ego that I think helped them connect.
is one of the reasons they had this last trait, which I agree with you on everything you said, is they had both had prolonged and or significant periods of failure.
Yeah, that's very true. Grant had struggled in business. It just, things weren't going as well as he had wanted. And Lincoln too, in addition to suffering political losses, he suffered personal losses. And so, yeah, they both had some Phoenix rising from the ashes type moments that I think helped keep them grounded and kept their egos in check.
I agree with you. Grant's my favorite person of the war. Grant and Longstreet. Everyone could choose Lincoln, but besides him. And Grant, fortunately, has undergone a significant reevaluation, not only of his performance as general, but also as president. But to me, the most American story in all of America in its history is in 1860, Grant was selling firewood on the street.
Yeah.
4 years later, he's the first lieutenant general since George Washington.
What a great story.
We have just a few more minutes with Joshua Claiborne before we ask him the five questions we ask all of our guests here on the Leaders and Legends podcast. Assessing Lincoln and the not just the historiography, but his performance, is there anything about Lincoln as president that you find disappointing?
Probably the most disappointing thing, and the thing that has gotten a lot more attention as we've reassessed so many of our historical figures, is that for a time he endorsed sending blacks back to Africa.
The American Colonization Society.
Yeah, the American Colonization Society. Now, I think the historical scholarship, and there's a historian named John White who's done just tremendous work in this area, that so much of that was to make emancipation palatable to the South and try and get them to go along with it, or even others in the North that were opposed to it, because that colonization was not forced. It was voluntary. And he thought that he could tell people, we're going to free the slaves, but we'll provide the means for them to go back to Africa if they want to. And he thought that would, again, be more palatable. But by the same token, he quickly, by his aides, wrote this at the time. It's very clear from his own demeanor. While that was a position at one time, he quickly abandoned it and realized not only is it not feasible, but it's not, in effect, not morally the right path. And so, again, it goes back to what I said earlier. I think he evolved, and we can be disappointed. But again, if his ultimate goal is to save the Union and free slaves, he was going to do it in whatever way he thought possible. And if he had to endorse a voluntary colonization to get others in the North to go along with it, so be it.
Do you also believe that one of the reasons, clearly when he talks about the colonization, it's rooted in the belief that blacks are never going to get a fair shake here. There's too much prejudice.
Absolutely,
there's too much racism. We've got to do something to protect them from the whites who are never going to accept them as equals.
Right.
But at the same time, I would have loved to have asked him, do you think he was surprised, if not shocked, and maybe heartened, that the vast majority of free blacks in the United States didn't want to leave?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. That's right. Yeah. And I think he understood the ramifications of letting them stay free in the North, or I'm sorry, in the South, in terms of how are we going to feed them? What kind of jobs are they going to have? That sort of thing. Those were all big questions that others in his administration had, others in the South that were supporters. And, you know, again, colonization was an answer to that, to offer them a carrot, so to speak, and say, we're going to address this by letting them go back. But to your point, either they didn't want to, and now to be fair, in many cases, they just didn't have the means to even get on a train to go somewhere where somebody will take them back. But yeah, I think he would have been surprised by that.
I'll make a statement and I'll put the ball on the tee for you for your last question. Lincoln's time in Indiana, is it exaggerated or is it underemphasized?
Underemphasized. I think, I'm going to say this, Robert, I don't want anybody to steal my idea, but working on a comprehensive Bible of Lincoln's time in Indiana, I hope and plan to pitch that as a fascinating, dramatic miniseries. Here's a guy who traveled through wilderness with his two parents and older sister, lived in a lean-to during a cold winter, lost his mother at age 9, lost his sister who was so close to him, had a tough upbringing, went on a flatboat trip to New Orleans, saw slavery, came back, was attacked by pirates on that flatboat trip, nearly died from things like getting kicked by horses to falling down. There is drama after drama, right? Had a falling out with the family that his sister was married into. I think for somebody that in my mind is one of the greatest leaders in Western civilization history, up there with any Roman leader you could think of or medieval leaders that we like to valorize. This guy is somebody that 1,000 years from now we'll be talking about. And he was born, raised, and molded right here in southwestern Indiana. We ought to tell that story, you know, better, more. It's important. And I think there's also some drama to maybe put this as a Netflix series. Robert, can you help me make that happen?
My goal is to get Chris Spangle to play Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, okay. There you go.
That's all we need to make this happen. We've reached the point in the Leaders and Legends podcast where we ask the same 5 questions of all of our guests. Mr. Claiborne listens to the podcast, which, by the way, thank you for doing
sure,
so.
Sure.
So he's familiar with these. So we'll get started. What was your first job?
My first job was working at a golf course, changing where the holes were on the pins and cutting grass.
What was your first concert?
Beach Boys.
With John Stamos?
No, I was too young to even know. This would have been in the mid 80s. So I don't
know. What was the first concert that you went where you bought the ticket?
Oh, where I bought the ticket. Yeah. Probably would have been I think it was Dave Matthews. Yeah.
You've redeemed yourself. Yeah, you're right.
That doesn't really count because my parents took me to the Beach Boys concert. So, yeah. I probably wouldn't have bought that myself.
If you could suggest any book for someone to read, which book would you recommend?
I'll just say right now of what I'm reading, there's a book, Justinian, by Peter Saris, who is an Oxford historian. Mm-hmm. My goodness, I think it's so clear, direct, it's readable, and what a fascinating, often overlooked period of time. Right after Rome had shifted its focus from Rome to what was then Constantinople and the rise of the Byzantine Empire. So much of that still influences us in the West. And we, I think, too often ignore what Byzantine culture offered and was and how it still influences us. So I love this book. I think it's readable and accessible. Highly recommend. And
the Justinian era is fascinating. Yeah. And it's interesting, perhaps because of that era, in my view, Justinian isn't the most compelling figure. It's either his general, Belisarius, if you've read Procopius, which I had to do in graduate school, or his wife.
There's another one that Netflix really needs to get on and turn a great miniseries into. Yeah.
Yeah. Theodora, could not be on regular television.
That's true. That's true. for those listening, there was some prostitution involved, et cetera. But
she was brilliant. She was absolutely brilliant and a courageous leader.
Very compassionate, yes. Now, the historian you mentioned did not like Justinian, but he's the best historian we have at the time. They had a falling out. Some argue he didn't give Justinian a fair shake, but regardless.
Number 4, you never know when there's going to be a Procopius mention in your everyday life. Number 4, if you could witness any event in history, be there in person as it happens, which event would you choose?
I guess this is cliche. I'd have to go back to Christ's crucifixion and see that.
As opposed to the resurrection?
What's that? Well,
as opposed to the resurrection?
I guess I took that all as one sort of week to see. But yeah, no, if you're going to say one event, it would definitely be the resurrection. Yeah.
Number 5, if you could have dinner with anyone living today, 2 hours off the record, just to chat, whom would you choose?
I don't know how sexy of an answer this is, but it would be undoubtedly Paul McCartney. I am a Beatles fanatic. I think there are a few people who have lived life to its fullest and seen as much of modern culture and modern society and had a hand in shaping modern culture as Paul McCartney.
He would certainly be in my top 5. I mean, forget music, but when it comes to most famous people in the world, it's him, it's the Pope, it's the President of the United States.
Yeah.
And then I'm struggling.
Yeah.
You have been listening to Leaders and Legends. That's a great response, Joshua. A podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, an Indiana-based public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Garmon Construction, Leaders and Legends LLC, the Grand Hall and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, the McGinley's Golden Ace Inn, and NFP, a national insurance broker with strong local content. As always, all our podcast interviews are dedicated to the legacy and generosity of P.E. McAllister. Our guest, Joshua Claiborne, I think you should go to their website. It's joshclaiborne.com. It's got his books, publications, research. It's a terrific website. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And actually, let me thank you again for your work with regard to Lincoln Scholarship. There is always something new to learn.
Thank you, Robert. I appreciate it. Love to join you today, and we'll continue to be a regular listener on this great podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. If you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's robert@veteranstrategies.com.